Accession number 29243, Reel 2.
Up at Pilotswood, over there on the west, and that was literally like daylight. And they dropped the same night they dropped bombs on Filston Farm. Now, they didn't actually get the house, but they destroyed quite a number of farm buildings. And this particular night, it was, you know, so bad that 14 cows were killed in one of the barns. Now, because of that particular raid, because that went on for nearly all night, it went on for, because planes after planes were coming over. Then the Mr. Manning came to the school and he gave us a lecture on incendiaries, saying that they'd be laying about in the all over the place and we were not to touch them. So anyway, we boys, being boys, thought, well, you know, God, if all these incendiaries are laying about, let's go looking for some, shall we? So we goes off looking for these bombs. And we found one. We found one in the field just over there. It's now Beechmast. That field out there. And we found this one. There was three of us. It was Derek Day, Georgie Smith and myself. And as I was the youngest of the three, we said, well, what are we going to do with this? They said, well, we take it to Mr. Manring. So he said, okay, fine. So, but as you're the youngest, you carry it, Raisy. So he picks this incendiary up. It's about that long, about a foot long, when you've seen an incendiary. And anyway, I picks this up. I thought, yeah, as long as it don't go bang. So, yeah, that'd be all right. Yeah, let's take it down to a room. So anyway, we went down to Mr. Manning's house in Church Street, and which was opposite where the spinney is now. Knocked on the door. Mr. Manning came out. I can assure you that was taken away from me so quick. You wouldn't believe. He took it round the back and put it in a bucket of sand. And did he give us a lecture? So, you know, we was a... Then another guy, George Chatfield, and that was Alice Wingate next door. She probably, I don't know if you've talked to Alice, but her brother, he found one in the river. And he was about 14 at the time. And he decided to bring it home. Because it'd been a river, he thought, oh, that's all right. Took it up in his bedroom, apparently. Anyway, then he decided that he wanted to take the fins off. And he took the fins off, and it exploded in his hands. And it blew three fingers off. So, you know, we got more lectures at school. You know, I can always remember Mr. Manning used to be so keen. He used to come down there. He really used to go on at us. But, you know, looking back on it, obviously he was quite right to do that. Because, you know, as lads, we thought, oh, this is great, let's go and find a bomb, shall we, you know. It was like when the Dornier had crashed. Now, when that crashed, I was really too young to actually be allowed to go along and look at it. But I can certainly remember, I'm sure I can remember the night about it, because I always remember my father saying, and it was, this is one thing that stuck in my mind, that he said that, God, there's that one's coming low. He says, could hear this sort of big plane coming round. And he said, it's on fire too. He said, that's going to crash over in Castle Farm, I reckon, he said, or Ainsford. So, and then the next thing, well, it did crash, and, you know, everyone who were on their feet were tried to get there and that. But I think the Home Guard sort of dealt with it. And they got one of the... I know that they got two people out of it, Germans out of it, and literally Mr. Benny Greenwood, Major Greenwood, I think he bought one of the pilots or one of the air crew a pint in the Crown, I think it was. But, you know, this is, from my point of view, it was just hearsay what I'd heard. From incendiary's point of view, I think one of the closest we'd ever actually come ourselves was, you know, one night there was a raid going on and you could hear the sort of shrapnel falling. You could hear the bombs going off, and the hill was alighter again for another time, but not quite as bad as the night I previously said. And you know, my father used to stand outside, used to turn the light out, have the front door open, and because we lived up Bowers Road there, you could look right across the valley, because most of the planes used to come from either over there, from the east there, or from over there, the northeast over there. And he used to stand and sort of watch them, but he would stand inside the door. Anyway, one night there was this terrific bang and a slither, and it was a great casing of what they used to carry these incendiary bombs in. It hit our roof, slid down the roof, went down to the front gate, and we used to have two trees at the bottom of the garden, just either side of the gate, and it cut one of these trees in half. And that casing, we kept up our garden all for literally years after the war. What happened to it? I think Dad had to clear out one day and decided to get rid of it. But you know, I always remember that, because you had this big sheet of metal which was sort of full of bullet holes, and or at least I assumed it was bullet holes, but it stood up our garden for ages just because of what it was. You know, and another time I used to have to go to Sunday school down the Baptist church in Crown Road. Now my grandparents lived in Crown Road, so after Sunday school I'd go down and say hello to Gran and Grandad. And as I went in through his gate, I found this cannon shell just laying there. So I picked it up and took it in to Grandad and said, "Look, Grandad, look what I've found." And, you know, it was literally taken from me so quick that, you know, I think it was taken away from me quicker than it came out of the sky. He took it down to the allotments and left it down there, I assume. So what he did with it in the end, I don't really know to this day. I know he took it away from me. And for the first time ever, Grandad gave me a lecture on what I should and shouldn't pick up. But I suppose, how old was I then? I suppose I was about eight, I suppose I was when that happened. Then, of course, there was the Doodlebugs. That was another period where they were frightening, because I think it was the only time when it was a bit frightening, because they would come over, the engine had stopped, and suddenly there'd be a terrific bang and a shaking. And you know, you think, well, where'd that come from? There was nothing, no warning, nothing. But we had balloons all the way round. There was balloons all the way right through the valley, and then, and there was one balloon which was actually at the top of Scurvylands. You know, as you go around the bend from Filston to Sepham, there was one in the field just there. And the sergeant who was in charge of that site, he used to come to my parents' home on a Sunday for Sunday lunch. We used to sort of give Sunday lunch to one of the crew or that, because obviously they all couldn't come. So every Sunday they always came, one of them came. And this particular Sunday, I used to go along to the site and then walk back with the airman in. And this particular day was a sergeant. And anyway, we was walking back, and we got as far as where Hot Garden Cottage is now, because they weren't there then. And we saw this doodlebug come, and it come up over the east there, and we could see it coming across, and then suddenly it caught a balloon cable, and as it sort of went bare like that, the sergeant looked at me, and he literally grabbed me by the scruff of the neck, threw me over the hedge, and jumped on top of me. And well, I didn't see anymore until there was, you know, until it exploded. That was one thing I'll always remember, that one. And I shall always remember the one which fell in down in the village itself. It was according to my father, it was coming right towards the middle of the village. And because it had been either shot at by another aircraft, but it was still flying. But as it came over the valley itself, the engine just stopped. And then it literally dived into the village, and it fell down by the River Darrant, and it destroyed Meadow Cottage. There's quite a lot of buildings there now, but there was just the one cottage there at the time. I think there was an old chap in there. I can't remember his name. For the life of me, I can't remember his name. But he lived there, and he'd been trapped underneath a bed for a while, and he was just slightly injured, but nobody was killed, fortunately. But the fuselage of that particular V1, it lay across the path, literally for months. But there was two or three incidents like that where, they'd be coming across, and whether they'd either clipped or touched a balloon cable or not, but they were very low, and they used to come straight across these houses here. And you could almost hear them touching the trees as they went across. And I just come one night, one afternoon. It must have been summer because, it was late and it was still very light, because I think at that particular time we was having double summertime, and, the sun was still shining at 10 o'clock at night, And this doodlebug came up over there. Mother was at the garden talking to a neighbour and that, and, I went up, I was up at the garden somewhere. Next minute, we see this doodlebug coming. And we thought, gosh, that's so low that it is going to hit us. We were convinced it was coming straight for us. And because then my mother did the usual and jumped, threw me to the ground and jumped on top of me. And the next thing is it's just skimming across the trees and then exploded the other side of the, in the valley over the other side of the trees. See, that's why I think they were more frightening than the bombs themselves. We had exciting times. At least from my point of view. What's an exciting time? One of the exciting things I remember is when a Messerschmitt actually came and shot up the high street. And it started off over there. It was one morning, we were just getting ourselves ready for school. And, mother says, come on then, get your breakfast, come on, get cracking. I said, oh, yeah, all right. And the siren hadn't gone, but suddenly we heard this aeroplane, and it was over there, and my mother said to her, that sounds like a Jerry, because they had a different beat to them, and he thought, that's a Jerry, that one is. So the next thing is to see this plane come across the, coming just above the tops of them trees. We was there, but we could see they're coming over the tops of these trees here. And you could hear the machine gun going. You thought, gosh, what's he doing? He's literally blasting hecky out the village, and he went straight for the village and then disappeared. Anyway, he think, well, who's hurt? And anyway, mother goes out to find out if anyone had been hurt. No one had been hurt. There was just one death. Joe Suggett lost his rabbit, because apparently Joe Suggett came out and he said, it's just all them bloody Jerry's, he says. He said, they blew and killed my rabbit. And he said, he was quite upset because they'd killed his rabbit. And that was quite exciting. And the other, and one of the other instances I can remember is when we was in the hop garden. There was two Junkers 88s. They came over, and they'd literally started off over here, over this way here. And they came up through Shoreham itself, and then they came across the hop garden. So we used to have, my mother always used to have half a bin. And as a boy, I used to have to fill, before I could go off and play, I had to fill up so many umbrellas, upturned umbrellas of hops. And once I'd done that, then I could go off and play. And this particular time, and I was thinking, God, I've got to pick these blooming hops and that. And I was picking my hops into my umbrella. And then we heard these aircraft coming. He said, God, look at that. And then two or three of the lads and that, we all got together. He says, God, isn't that good? Yeah, yeah. And then they started to come up across the hop garden. Then they started firing their guns, you see. But we thought, there was no bullets around us. But you could hear them firing their guns. And then they stopped. And then they just went off. But we thought that was quite exciting to see these 2 hours. I suppose they were about, because it's always difficult to remember, or gauge distances. But I suppose there was about 300 or 400 yards between them, as it were, as they disappeared over Pole Hill. It's only other instances like that I can remember. I think I can remember the night that the Germans decided to bomb the east end of London, because that was a little bit different to the sort of run-of-the-mill sort of thing. Although it didn't actually happen over here, we saw it from here. I saw quite a bit of it from here. And, you know, I think the reason I remember it is I can always remember my father. He'd come back and he'd say, God damn, poor Paris is up in the East End and I'm going through it now. Because you could see these aeroplanes very high, but they were coming over in formation, and it was something that, you know, we'd never seen before. It probably happened further over, but we'd never actually seen it. And they were literally coming over in wave after wave after wave. And, you know, you could see little aircraft sort of going round them, and it was so stark in it, and you could hear the bombs and the guns going off, and literally the whole sky was sort of flashing. Even in daylight you could see the flashes and that. And I suppose that was when the East End was really bombed quite heavily. But, you know, I'm not saying that it definitely was, but it's one of the things I can remember, and I'm sure that must have been what it was. You know, or I think all we saw of it was just the odd aircraft which might have come across and just dropped a few bombs or something like that. But, you know, I don't think that particularly affected Shoreham in any way. But it's something that, you know, I can remember, and I can remember it being talked about at that particular time.
Can you tell us anything about daily life in the? I mean, you were you've told us a bit about the Home Guard and the ARP and all this sort of thing. Did you see any Home Guard exercises and that sort of thing?
Yes, they used to march. They used to collect at Coombe Hollow, because Major Greenwood, he lived at Coombe Hollow, and, you know, that was headquarters. And then they used to do duty on Donkey Bank, which is the bank opposite, you know, where Dalhalla is. And so therefore they always used to do night duty. They used to take it in turns to do night duty on Donkey Bank, but then they would march down to the village, and because they went, all these guys, they did normal work anyway. You know, my father did quite long hours. He used to have a push bike all the way out to Betts Wood before he'd sort of started work, then push bike home. And, you know, very often he'd be cycling down Chelsford Lane when there was a raid on, and you know, there's trace of bullets flying all around him, as it were. And because mother would be worried sick, because he hadn't been home and there was a raid on and he hadn't got back. And I suppose, you know, it was about 8 o'clock at night before he'd get back home. But then he would have to go out on duty. And, you know, one night he said, well, he said, look, I've been going out since 5 o'clock this morning. I always remember him saying this. He said, you know, I've been going out since 5 o'clock this morning. He said, here I am, he said, 8 o'clock at night, he says. And he says, now they want me to go up Donkey Bank. Oh, he says, well, you know, when am I going to get some sleep? Anyway, there was a bit of an argument about it, but he went and did what he had to do, I suppose. But then they, as I say, they used to march down through the village when they was doing their exercise. They'd come onto the recreation ground. Now, just at the top of the recreation ground, on the top right-hand side, there was, you know, the hut, which is there now. There was another hut there. And then just on the side, they'd got a big sand pit, which was dug. And that's where the Home Guard used to practice. They used to get in, collect in the bandstand, because there was a bandstand where the tennis court is now. There used to be an old bandstand for, you know, the village band, which they had in the 1920s. And they used to sort of do their practice firing their weapons on that. I think at the early part of the war, they didn't even have any weapons, I think, you know, pitchforks and things like that. Things went on in the village in the same way, as far as that scout concerned. Stanley Brown, he was the scout master in those days. His wife was Mrs. Brown. We used to call her Mum, I think the reason being was that in the sort of late 20s and early 30s, apparently when they used to go to camp there, one of the lads, you know, when they went round to the Kent tent line saying, good night, lads, you know, good night, Skipper, and good night, Mrs. Brown, and or Arkayla, or whatever she was. And then one night, one lad says, yeah, good night, Mum. You know, and she got that name for the day she died, which was, when did she die? I suppose she must have died in about the 1970s, I think. So scouting went on in the same way. I was obviously a cub in them days, and you know, we had to go on parade. And when we went on parade, there was always the home guard were there, the air raid wardens, they were there, but we was proud scouts and cubs, and we had our yellow flag for the cubs and the green flag for the scouts. And that was quite something which we used to like doing. What else did we do?
Did you have a lot of outsiders came to the village, you know, soldiers? You mentioned the airmen and the balloons.
Yeah. Well, the army actually took over Shoreham Place. Now, Lord Mildmay, he obviously at that time was living at his property in Fleet in Hampshire. Probably a little bit safer than possibly here. And the army, I would imagine that they literally commandeered it as a station. And they literally used it as a headquarters. And they had two sentry boxes which used to stand outside the main gates. Which, now the main gate was where the lodge house is now. Yeah. That was the actual main gate there. And the two big concrete balls that you see further back in Shoreham Place, they were on big pillars either side of big iron gates there. And they had two sentry posts there, and there was always soldiers stationed there, and one had another sentry box up at the station. So there was always sort of soldiers on duty at the station and outside there. And one soldier, and I think he's actually buried in the churchyard now, if we look there, he was literally on duty, and he literally on the Australia, he'd taken his hat off for some reason, or he'd taken his helmet off, and an incendiary came right through the sentry box and killed him outright. That was one thing that I remember about it. They used to come, the soldiers obviously used to come into the village. In fact, some of the soldiers married girls from the village. In fact, one of them still alive now is Doug Ward. He came to the village as a soldier. He met Peggy Cheeseman, who lived at the top of Bowers Road. They married, and, you know, they're still here. I think there was two or three people that happened to Jack, yeah, because they're both dead now. Jack Flower, he was a soldier, and he married Monica Reeder, and they lived in Bowers Road. You know, there were several like that. Oh yeah, Jack Ballant, he married Nancy De Decker. So, see, quite a number of the soldiers who actually came here lived there. Now, there was one particular soldier who got friendly with my father, and he used to come home. He used to go to the George for a drink, and then he'd come and have lunch with us and that. And, you know, they invited, my parents invited his family to come and stay with us. And from now and again, they'd come for a weekend. They lived in Lincolnshire, their home, and you know, I think my parents conversed with them for many years, you know, until they sort of died, as it were, you know. They had one little girl who was just a little bit younger than me, and, you know, we used to come down, we used to play together. These are things which were associated with the army.
Did you have others, you know, land girls, displaced persons, POWs?
Yes, there were land girls, yeah. They used to come here, obviously work on the farms. Yeah, there was one, Queenie Lambie. Now, she came from, obviously from Scotland, and she married a local chap, and they moved in, stayed in the village, and her brother came to work on the farm at Preston, Wally Lambie, and he eventually became the manager of the farm at Preston. The land girls themselves, I don't know where they were billeted or anything like that, but they used to come to the village quite regularly, and they'd sort of join in with the local pub activities and things like that in leisure time, and they would work either for the ones I remember, they worked either for Mr. Hitchcock, which was obviously Frank Hitchcock's father, or John Dennis, not the present John Dennis, that was Harold's father. Talking of that, there was also prisoners of war. German prisoners of war used to come and work on the farm. And in fact, what we knew of them, they were quite friendly, you know. They would talk to you, and they were, seemed to be quite friendly, and they seemed to be quite, well, I suppose enjoy was probably the wrong word for it, but you know, they accepted their lot, as it were. You know, they must have been treated quite well, they, particularly at the farm, because I know at the farm, because my mother worked in the farmhouse. My grandmother worked for the old Mr. Dennis. My mother worked, that was later when my mother worked at the farm, because my mother was an auxiliary nurse at Hartford. But my grandmother said that she always said that she, that, you know, they used to sort of give them milk and eggs and things like that, or from the farm to supplement what they were doing. So they obviously came here in a truck or something, and then they were taken away again at the end of the day. But, you know, prisoners of war did actually work on the farms in the village, along with the land girls.
Okay, well, I think that you said you were telling us you had stories to tell about the Morrison shelter. Have we covered that?
Yeah, we have, really, because I think with the one, you know, I suppose I could have elaborated on the one where my father didn't get his head chopped off with a piece of incendiary casing which came down across the roof. Now, obviously, as he used to stand and watch the bombs, you know, on the bombs, watch the fight going on, as a youngster, I wanted to watch as well. Now, then, back in the, you know, it was always, get in the shelter. And I'd say, yeah, okay. So I'd be in the shelter, then I'd be getting out of the shelter, I'd be creeping around. The next thing is I'm looking around Dad's legs. Yeah, and so I'd say, what are you doing? Get yourself back in. And, you know, it was one of those constant battles where I wanted to watch what Dad was watching, but I was always sort of, you've got to get back in that shelter.
Can you remember things like rationing, queuing, that sort of thing?
Well, we didn't have queuing as such. Yes, I can remember rationing. We used to have, my book was a blue book because I was a child. And in that book there was a sweet ration. Now, the sweet ration was the most important thing to us. They were now there was an E and there was a D on these sweet coupons, and you could go down to either Mr. Joy or Mr. Cox or Mr. Bell if they'd got sweets. Then they would have to, we would allow so many sweets. Now, we didn't buy them by the quarter, because if you bought them, that was being extravagant. You'd use all your sweet ration up. So what you did is you bought a gobstopper, you bought an ounce of sweets, or at the most 2 ounces if you really like them. And then we'd supplement that with things like locust beans. What else did we used to have? Locust beans, licorice root. We used to get that because they weren't on ration. And that was great, that was, because, you know, you could sit there chewing away, then get yourself into trouble at school because you were chewing a licorice a root. The locust beans, I didn't really like them, but it was something. Now, there was always an argument between the co-op and Mr. Joy over Kit Kats. Now, Kit Kats were on the food rationing. They weren't for the sweets. But Mr. Joy says they were for sweets. If you wanted a Kit Kat off him, you had to give your sweet ration up. But the co-op said, no, it's not. It's food coupon you have to have for Kit Kat, you know, biscuits and things like that. And well, you know, there was always an argument. So where do we get them from? You know, he's got Kit Kat. No. You'll give us one of them. You'd have to give up one of your sweet coupons if you had that. So we always used to go to the co-op to get if we wanted a Kit Kat. But then Mum had to buy that. What else was there in that line?
Do you remember VE Day?
Do I remember VE? Yes. We had a party. We had a big party in the village hall. Somewhere I've got a. There's a photograph of that, of the party. Now, in the part, when you look at a party now with your.